And while counsel is getting set up, I'll just have the marshal call the next case.
Now calling case number A231464, Alvin Glay, trustee for the next of kin of Unity McGill, appellant versus RC of St. Cloud Inc., respondent.
Okay, welcome. No need to stand if you're ready. Just wanted to let you know that you'll each have 15 minutes to present your initial argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The podium does move up and down in the center, and there is a clock on the front, so you should be able to see your time there. And I would just ask that at the beginning of your argument, you identify yourself and your client for the record. We are creating an audio recording of this that will be available on the court's website within about 24 hours. So with that, counsel for appellant, feel free to adjust the podium, and you may begin when you are ready. There are 15 minutes on the clock.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I am Joel Smith. With me is my co-counsel, Kara Rahimi. We are with the Kozierodsky Smith Law Firm. Also present in the courtroom are the authors of the amicus brief on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, Michael Bryant and Tucker Isaacson. May it please the court. Our client, Dr. Alvin Glay, who is the trustee for the next of kin of his deceased brother, Unity McGill, asks this court for a new trial on the issues of causation and damages. This is a wrongful death case. The liability is based on a failure by a bar to protect a patron, Unity McGill, from the eventual murderous acts of other patrons in the bar. In this case, the jury determined, based on the innkeeper's liability law that they were instructed on, that the bar was in fact negligent. Of course, we're not asking for a new trial on that finding. The court adopted it. It has not been appealed or otherwise pursued in terms of a remedy by the respondent. So I believe the finding of negligence remains intact. That finding of negligence was based on an innkeeper's liability. The Minnesota Civil Jury Instruction Guide, fortunately, provides a proposed instruction on that. And there's four factors, and the fact finder has to find all four of them in order to say, yes, the bar in this case was negligent. Number one, did the bar, was it put on notice of the offending person's vicious or dangerous potential by some act or threat? The jury said yes. Was the bar, did it have an adequate opportunity to protect the injured person, Unity McGill? The jury said yes. Did the bar fail to take reasonable steps to protect Unity McGill? The jury, in effect, said yes. Was that injury, the fatal attack of Unity McGill, foreseeable, which occurred on the dance floor of this bar? The jury said yes. That's not contested. What is contested is something that is normally, and I've never been an appellate court judge, but I'm going to pretend what's on your mind. Aren't causation issues usually an issue that's a fact? And if it's a fact issue, we work really hard to try to find a reasonable basis that supports the findings of the court, trial court, and the jury. The reason we can't do that here is because the mistakes that were made, and I will say, Judge Mahler, the trial court judge, worked very hard on these issues. She knew that there would probably be some eyes outside her courtroom evaluating her decisions, and I know she worked hard on them.
Mr. Smith, can I jump to the apportionment issue, and then we'll come back?
Yeah, of course.
Isn't it true that your client, that you initially proposed a jury instruction on the allocation of fault?
Yeah.
But I understand that subsequently you sought that it not be given. My question is this, though, like you did, or your client did, for superseding cause, there was a specific objection. Was there ever a specific objection on the record to the allocation instruction?
There was, Your Honor, and I know it is cited in our brief, which pages of the record support that. I objected before trial and throughout trial, leading up even to the point of jury instructions and the special verdict form. And yes, early on, our initial filings, motions in limine, witness lists, and everything else, I submitted on behalf of my client a proposed special verdict form that did contain some apportionment.
And to clarify then, you did not object, in fact, specifically requested, because it had to be whether the causation instruction and the definition. So there's no objection to that.
Well, they're intertwined.
Well, but so, I mean, the specific question on the verdict form and the definition of it, no one disputed, because it was an accurate statement of the law in terms of whether negligence was a cause of the injury.
I did submit an amended special verdict form well in advance of the trial and well known to the parties and to the judge. Frankly, as you all probably know, trials are a little bit like making sausage. And, you know, even the court and the respondent's attorney were zigging and zagging throughout the trial. And
the direct question is question four on the verdict form. That there was no objection to that.
Question four on the verdict form was the
direct cause.
Not to that specific question. Okay. And so, I think that's appropriate. I mean, that question should be on there.
Okay. So, speaking for myself, I was somewhat persuaded by the judge's explanation that it had deferred the question of apportionment generally, because there was pretrial motions regarding it until liability attached. And her point was, as I understand it, obviously once they said no, it was a moot point. Why is that wrong?
So having the direct cause question on the verdict form is proper. It's part of a basic negligence case. Where it gets tangled is when then the next question relates to superseding cause. And you might say, well, Mr. Smith, the jury didn't even have to answer that question, so how is that, you know, an issue in this case? Well, because on the jury instruction, it specifically tells the jury, after the instruction on causation, you know, a substantial factor in bringing about the harm, then there's superseding cause, which tells the jury a cause is not a direct cause when there is a superseding cause. And one of the two points I'm trying to hit on here, that this is an error of law, not of fact, is that in addition to allowing the jury to compare the fault, and we'll get to that in a moment, but also telling them a superseding cause allows them this confusion of I've just decided what negligence is, where it includes foreseeability, and now superseding cause has this instruction that it wasn't foreseeable.
But how do we, if we presume, which the law does, that they follow the instructions, and of course they followed, as the judge pointed out, the verdict form, don't answer this question, how are you able to show a prejudicial harm if we presume that they stopped at that point because there was no causation, so they didn't consider superseding?
Well, because the instructions to the jury precede filling out that form, and those instructions, when they include instructions on comparing fault of a negligent tortfeasor with intentional actors, despite statutory law in Minnesota and case law in Minnesota, which we'll get to, but then also allowing them to consider superseding cause, when it's illogical to answer that question when you've already answered the innkeeper's liability question, because answering yes to innkeeper's liability obviates having to answer with regard to superseding cause, if you look at what the particular elements are.
Did your client object to the foreseeability inclusion in the innkeeper instruction?
No, and I think that was an important, it was something that everybody agreed upon. The judge proposed it. We felt that that was appropriate for the jury to consider.
So if there was an agreement on that instruction, and is that, your, as I understand your brief, that's part of your argument as to why the there could be potential confusion because obviously if something's foreseeable, then it cannot be superseding. But if there's no objection to that instruction, then how do we address an objection that's not made to the district court on that very point?
My objection is to including the superseding cause instruction and question on the special verdict form because of the agreement on what the innkeeper's liability was. So the record, in my briefs, I've cited multiple times where we opposed including superseding cause, including part of the record where the trial court judge recognized having that superseding cause instruction could be perverse. But for whatever reason, she went ahead and included it in the instructions and on the special verdict form. And even though the jury didn't answer those particular questions on the special verdict form, doesn't mean that our parties didn't now argue about it and present those arguments to the jury. And so we have a situation where the jury determined that the bar failed to protect Unity McGill from the criminal acts that could arguably be, and were argued, were a superseding cause. The two don't go together. It's illogical, and that's where the error was.
So again, just to clarify, you're asking us to presume in an unanswered question, they nevertheless use the unanswered question to answer the preceding question to answer no.
I don't think we have to presume because courts have recognized the risk of, this does tangle with allowing the jury to consider comparative fault. The Honorable John Thunheim in the ADT security case, which is discussed throughout the briefs, recognized the risk of allowing the jury to consider and listen to argument about considering the acts of intentional actors in comparison to the fault of the negligent actor. To get to your point where we don't have to presume it is, you know, Judge Thunheim recognized that by preventing the jury from weighing the fault of a party that was merely negligent alongside the fault of a party that intentionally caused harm, allows the negligent party to unjustly minimize their exposure because, and then the Judge Thunheim goes on to cite a case from another jurisdiction, VEAZEY, which is cited in our reply brief, any rational juror will apportion the lion's share of the fault to the intentional tortfeasor when instructed to compare the fault of the negligent tortfeasor to an intentional tortfeasor. For example, a bar who lets these men in, kicks them out, and then lets them in again, and now the other patron, Unity McGill, is ambushed and attacked by these three men. It was that act that the bar had a duty to protect Mr. McGill from occurring.
But isn't it true, under no scenario were they not going to know about what those three defendants did, and in fact your client sued them directly in the amended complaint, so they were going to, and everybody agreed that the answers to their liability would be on the verdict form. So what I'm trying to understand, and yet they didn't answer that question, so again, aren't you asking us to assume, therefore, they took into account the apportionment in a non-answered verdict form in order to answer then the liability with regard to the bar?
So what was on the special verdict form with regard to the three assailants was Judge Mailer filling in yes for, you know, did they do it? And number two, was that a causal, you know, relationship to the death? And that's yes. So yeah, the jury did have that. But then the jury also had instruction on you can consider and compare that fault, and it's not even fault as far as the intentional actors, it's not defined as fault, with the fault of the negligent tortfeasor. And on the special verdict form where there's, you know, party A, party B, blank, blank percentage, it has to add up to 100%. It infects the mind of the jury with the very poison that Judge Thunheim was recognizing is if the reason we don't allow this comparison is because I think naturally we blame the people who murder, not so much the people that have an obligation to protect the victim from those bad actors.
So, counsel, is the concern that these the jury instructions, when all taken together, was confusing, that the jury had all of them at the time that they were deliberating, and that they were therefore influenced by the improper inclusion of foreseeability?
Yes. Well, I'm not opposed to foreseeability because that's part of the innkeeper's liability. And the jury found by their answer in yes to the negligence that the bar, it was foreseeable.
Superseding cause.
For superseding cause, the jury is allowed to consider argument from the bar that we couldn't have stopped this. This was something that these murderers were going to do. We didn't hold the knife or whatever it was. It was those guys. It was those guys. It was those guys. That's what the superseding and cause instruction and question the special verdict form allows the jury to consider. And then my time is up. And if you don't feel like you've answered your question,
you'll
I'll be
have,
happy to.
5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll turn to counsel for respondent next. And again, feel free to adjust the podium. The clock is reset. You can begin when you're ready.
May it please the court, I'm Gregory Zinn. I represent the respondent, RC of St. Cloud, doing business as the Red Carpet. I'm at the firm Gregory A. Zinn, PLC. I'm a solo practitioner. To pick up where we left off, the court answered questions 1 and 2 on the verdict form as to the assailant's liability and direct cause. The jury heard the evidence regarding the alleged negligence of the Red Carpet, and they found that the negligence existed, but no direct cause. And there's been no dispute here that that's a finding that they should make. The issue that is raised is with respect to, obviously, the assailants. The jury found zero damages, and that was because of the way that it was presented to the jury. From voir dire through closing, the appellant asked to punish. The jury faced with a punishment damage, or what the instruction told them was that you couldn't do that. It was all or nothing. They were asked for all. They gave nothing. It's supported by the evidence and the arguments.
The district court granted a new trial on damages, right?
It did. And if it goes back for a new trial on damages, it wouldn't include us if we're successful here as we were with the jury. I would caution that if it goes back for a new trial, that the court's comments that it made in that order, that it doesn't know of any reason that a person's fault or life should have no value, that's not the standard. That would be error to try a case on that standard. And so they raised the issue of the damages here. I briefed that, I think, and I'd like to get into, obviously, I think the court would like to get into the allocation and superseding cause. But since it was briefed, I addressed it, and I don't think it needs to go back. And since it was raised on appeal, this court has jurisdiction over that decision. If it goes back, then I would hope there would be an instruction that the law that is applied has to be the damages available under the Wrongful Death Act.
Well, my point is, if you don't prevail here on the superseding cause and we order a new trial on that liability front, it's a new trial on damages too, right? For everything, the three assailants.
I think that would be up to this court, because since it was raised, it can be decided that the damages of zero remain. Then obviously that makes the trial moot. But that issue is brought before you by the appellant, and I think you're entitled to decide it. And I think that the jury's verdict should be upheld. On the allocation issue, the jury never got to the allocation. They properly left it blank after having found no direct cause. There was no confusion. There wasn't any error. There were abundant facts that showed that any negligence that the jury may have applied would not have been a direct cause. I don't think that that's being disputed right now, and so I will leave it. What I think is being said is that the strict liability under the innkeeper's liability rule makes that unnecessary, as though the direct cause is irrelevant because there was foreseeability. Well, that's not true. It's a strict liability standard. All strict liability standards still require the jury to determine direct cause. There's strict liability in liquor liability, in many product liability cases. Even a dog bite case is strict liability, but direct cause has to be determined.
But I think the point appellant's making is that this superseding cause confused all causation questions that were put before the jury.
And I think that in answer to that, I would say that it does not. They never evaluated that. You can only speculate to say that it and the questions were asked in that vein, and I think that that's correct. How can you say by the verdict form when it says if you said no to question four, direct cause on the part of the respondent, then don't answer it, or only if you answer yes is what it said, then answer it. They followed that instruction to a T. There isn't an indication that they were somehow confused about the instruction. They asked no question about the superseding cause instruction, and we can't look at what they did or thought at the time. What we can do is say that if there are facts or evidence that support the verdict, that the verdict should be sustained. And here, one of the arguments was wanding, and there was evidence that the weapon was already on the second floor. And I argued in closing, if you find that was the negligence, then you are entitled to find there's no direct cause. That's outside of any superseding cause argument or anything. There was evidence to sustain the verdict. It should be sustained.
Mr. Zinn, if I understand correctly, the main argument that appellant's counsel was at trial level regarding superseding was the possible confusion, which is, of course, the argument now, too, that might occur between the foreseeability, the fourth prong of innkeeper liability, and then the superseding cause. My question is this. Generally, if I look at the case law on innkeeper liability, that fourth prong is not to be a jury decision, foreseeability. And yet the parties apparently agreed to do that.
No, I objected to it strenuously, and it was placed in there. They got everything that they asked for, and they can't come up here now.
You objected to the foreseeability as a...
It's not in the jig.
So the point being then the confusion was created by their desire to have a foreseeability added to the innkeeper for a fact-finding. Otherwise, with the superseding, would there be any argument of a possible confusion but for that foreseeability fourth prong that was... they were instructed on?
Two answers for that. If it was confusion based on their action, then they're not entitled to have a do-over on that. That's one. So I don't know if that how the jury evaluated that. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that they looked at that there was evidence to support a verdict with no direct cause, and they didn't go any farther than that. They didn't need to. They found that there was no direct cause, and then they skipped that. We don't know what weight they put on the various instructions or whether they understood them or not if they didn't ask a question. But if they are the cause of the confusion, they're not entitled to reverse that on appeal. If there was no confusion, then the decision should stand too. Those would be my two answers to that.
Counsel, I just want to make sure I'm understanding. Your point would be even if superseding cause was an error, that it was harmless because of the direct cause question that the jury decided?
I think so, because you can't impute confusion on the jury. He argued it, but you can't. There's no evidence that they were confused. Their conduct showed there was no confusion. They didn't ask a question, they answered no direct cause, and they skipped that question. And they skipped the allocation question for the same reason. The allocation question, because I don't have a lot of time left here, so I don't know if I want to, I'm not going to go through everything, but the appellant confuses allocation of liability under MnSTAT section 604.02 with comparative fault under 604.01. Keeps talking about comparing the comparative fault. That's not what was asked for. That's not what was done. That's not what the law in Minnesota says. 60402, as interpreted by Staub in 2014, said that several liability or separate liability is the rule. You only have joint liability with the four exceptions. Liability in excess of 50%, liability under common plan or scheme. Intentional tort is the third one. Statutory liability is the fourth one. The third and the fourth one are not comparative fault, negligence ideas or reasons. They're there, but they're still there. You still have to allocate. So a reallocation, first of all, again, we go to the verdict, and there was no direct cause. We don't really reach this question because there was no direct cause, so there was no allocation, and it was left blank. That's what we know from the jury, okay? But let's run through what happens under 60402, which the Staub case says we have to look at first. You need to put the responsibility or liability of all the parties, whether it's negligence, tort, or not, on the verdict form. So that when you get, that's under 60402 sub 1. So when you get to sub 2, you know if somebody needs to have a reallocation and pay something that's not theirs. That's true with an intentional tortfeasor that appellant says this was. They have to be on there because they're one of the exceptions. Or even a statutory liability, which can't be confused with comparative negligence or negligence and fault, has to be on there. And it makes sense because you have a situation where the, let's just call it the intentional tortfeasor. If they're 100% as here, then you never get to the second step, reallocation. If they're 0%, you never get to it. But you have to know it. You have to know what it is. What if it's 40%? Now, the intentional tortfeasor is 40%, and the remaining defendants have the other 60%. At some point, there may be a defendant who can't pay, and there has to be then a reallocation to the intentional tortfeasor. But you have to know if they're 40% and the others are 60, maybe the 20%er can't pay. Okay, the intentional tortfeasor is responsible for the 40%, and then they're responsible for any part of the 20% that that defendant can't pay. Even if that defendant is negligent on a fault basis and the intentional tortfeasor is not. The argument about ADT to come in here and say, well, it's a federal court case, and there are all kinds of warranties and other issues, negligence per se also in that one. But what would ADT do under the statutory scheme of 60402? It would say, you can't put them on the form. Then how do you know what their liability is? How do you know what the other's liability is? It's not by comparative fault, it's by allocated share. And how do you know what you might be responsible for if one of those other parties can't pay? It's not comparative fault. They keep saying it was comparative fault and you can't have an intentional tortfeasor have comparative fault. No, it's allocation under 60402. I've been doing this for 39 years. I've been involved in cases with bars and restaurants and hotels where there's a fight. The establishment is always on the form. And the assailant is always on the form. Look at Boone. Look at Minx that this court handled. There wasn't an issue there about whether they should be on the form. They had to be. There isn't any confusion from that. What did the assailants do? What did the bar do? Now, we didn't get to that in this case because in this case, there was no causation. There's no direct cause for any negligence. So I don't think that this is the hill that you do battle on for that big of an issue. This isn't where you decide if ADT is in and out. You don't have to get to it. If you are going to get to it, the ADT eviscerates 60402 sub 2. It makes it impossible. It doesn't make it moot. It makes it impossible. How can you, I went through the example. How can you know, though, if it's not done?
Counsel, did Staub involve, did it involve an intentional tortfeasor negligent tortfeasor?
No, but it involved, and I thank you for that, it involved tort negligence on the part of the diocese for not painting a yellow stripe on the top of the stairway, mm-hmm. and involved negligence of the spouse who pushed the other spouse in the wheelchair over. Now, here's
where... So it was a comparison of negligence.
But that wasn't what Staub was going after. Staub didn't spend all the time that it spent on going through legislative history to find out either how you do something between two comparative fault negligent parties, or even as the amicus says, merely to say that if you don't sue the party, you still have to put their liability on the form. Okay? What it did is it said several liability came into that case because they left the spouse off the form. It didn't have to do with whether there's intentional tort or not. It had to do with several liability. And the intentional tortfeasor here has several liability. It can only come back and pay somebody else's allocated share if somebody else with tort liability, or any kind of liability for that matter, can't pay all of their share. So the issue didn't hinge on whether it was intentional tort or negligence. It hinged on whether or not it was several liability. Several liability is put,
so you
on,
would agree
is
that
put
it's,
on the verdict
its application
form.
Here is limited to that issue then?
I'm sorry?
The application of Staub to the facts here is limited to the several liability question.
The application and the several liability question is the thing that does away with the ADT argument. And it also has to do with, this is not the intentional tortfeasor's fault being compared to any fault on the part of the respondent. And remember, there is none. That's theoretical. But if you're going to do it, should that allocation question have been on the form? And it had to be. Because as long as there's several fault and as long as 60402 is going to work, then you have to have put you must know what the allocated responsibility is for several liability. 60402 doesn't talk about fault or negligence or liability. It talks about responsibility and allocation of that responsibility. And again, bar, restaurant, hotel cases where there's been an assault, the bar or the hotel is always on, as well as the assailant.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. And we will turn back to counsel for appellant for 5 minutes of rebuttal. The clock is reset. You can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Thunheim in the ADT security case rejected that argument. He evaluated two veins of arguments, one based on under 604.01, comparative fault does not include parties who are not reckless or who are not negligent. It doesn't include, it includes negligent and reckless parties. It does not include and therefore excludes intentional actors from comparative fault. With regard to 604.02, the apportionment reapportionment law, Judge Thunheim rejected that argument saying, no, you are not without recourse. For the reasons that we don't want to poison a jury's mind about the negligent fault of the, in this case, a bar, by having them compare that to the, in this case, the murderer's actions, we don't want to poison the jury's mind with that, but the bar still has a remedy. Quote, this is ADT security, to the extent that a negligent party believes it shares the blame with a third party who committed an intentional act, the burden would be on the negligent party to bring a claim against the third party for contribution. In other words, the risk that the third party is insolvent would be borne by the negligent party instead of the victim. That was Judge Thunheim's best effort to predict what Minnesota law would be. I asked this court to seriously consider his reasoning in that case. But quickly, what caused confusion in this case was allowing the jury to consider and listen to argument about comparative fault and the issues on the superseding cause. Comparative fault, I believe the statute supports our position. Minnesota case law supports our position, in particular the Florenzano v. Olson case.
Counsel, could you focus On the second issue of whether or not the court abuses discretion by allowing the superseding cause instruction, it seemed that your opposing counsel was suggesting that it was by your own hand that the jury instruction included the elements that weren't in the original jig on foreseeability. And so I'm wondering if you could respond to that and whether, if that's the case, whether we can grant you relief on that piece.
Sure. As pointed out earlier, typically foreseeability is an issue for the court to determine. Not every time. If the court decides it's a close enough call or whatever the standard is, they can turn it over to the jury to make that decision. That's what I believe Judge Mahler did in this case, given her instructions on foreseeability and specifically as it related to innkeeper liability, which my understanding, that's not strict liability. It's neither here nor there, but I wouldn't agree that that's a strict liability law. But it made sense, and I did not disagree with Judge Mahler's proposal to include the instruction with that. I can't, on good faith, tell you what was or wasn't argued on that issue by defense counsel, but I can say that the record would indicate that. So, foreseeability made sense. If the judge didn't feel like it was her call to make that decision ahead of time, then, and if she felt it was appropriate for the jury to make that decision in her place, she still has the option to evaluate post-trial, you know,
the jury's verdict. So what precisely is the error then?
Comparative fault. It confused the jury. It should never have been part of what the jury was allowed to listen to or consider in terms of to what degree was the bar negligent or not. And so to couple that with the actions and to say we need to compare the actions of these murderers to the bar to determine the extent of the bar's liability, that was an error of law because it confused the jury for reasons that we don't even have to presume. They've been articulated by Judge Thunheim and other courts, how it overly affects the jury's evaluation. And then the superseding cause allows the jury a second chance to reevaluate their decision on innkeeper's liability, which two things Judge Mahler recognized as potentially being perverse and in fact perverse. One was including superseding cause, but she provided that anyway, and I know my time's up. The second one is she recognized that the jury's verdict of a zero damages for reasons that she laid out and articulated in her order was perverse. And I think that is all I'll say. Thank you.
Okay.
A question, if I may.
Yes, please.
On the damages question, which you just raised, your opposing counsel says that that's before us and that we can weigh in on the zero damages decision. It seems to me that you only appealed the part of it that you didn't get a new trial on damages, and so that if you prevail here, you do get a new trial on damages.
Right, because, I mean, the same principles apply whether the wrongful death damages were against the three assailants, as the judge found the verdict to be perverse. It didn't justify a new trial from her standpoint because her focus was on the liability and she supported the jury's verdict on liability and causation. I can't tell you what Judge Mahler would have decided if she had reversed herself, on the issues of causation. My thought is, based on her analysis, she would have allowed then a new trial on damages against, you know, whoever the defendant was going to be.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you to all counsel for the argument here today and for the briefs that were submitted. Thank you for the amicus brief as well. We will take all of this under consideration and issue a decision in this opinion within the statutory time frame. Thank you.